in order that they may make this firm resolution, keep it, and put it into practice, an oft-repeated consideration of their state of life, and a diligent reflection on the sacrament they have received, will be of great assistance to them. Let them constantly keep in mind that they have been sanctified and strengthened for the duties and for the dignity of their state by a special sacrament, the efficacious power of which, although it does not impress a character, is undying. To this purpose we may ponder over the words full of real comfort of Holy Cardinal Robert Bellarmine, who with other well-known theologians with devout conviction thus expresses himself: "The sacrament of matrimony can be regarded in two ways, first, in the making, and then in its permanent state. For it is a sacrament like to that of the Eucharist, which not only when it is being conferred, but also whilst it remains, is a sacrament. For as long as the married parties are alive, so long is their union a sacrament of Christ and the Church." 83. 111. "Yet in order that the grace of this sacrament may produce its full fruit, there is need, as we have already pointed out, of the cooperation of the married parties, which consists in their striving to fulfill their duties to the best of their ability, and with unwearied effort. For just as in the natural order men must apply the powers given them by God, with their own toil and diligence, that these may exercise their full vigor, failing which no profit is gained, so also men must diligently and unceasingly use the powers given them by the grace which is laid up in the soul by this sacrament. Let not, then, those who are joined in matrimony neglect the grace of the sacrament which is in them." 84. 4. "In applying themselves to the careful observance, however laborious, of their duties, they will find the power of that grace becoming more effectual as time goes on, and if ever they should feel themselves to be overburdened by the hardships of their condition of life, let them not lose courage, but rather let them regard in some measure as addressed to them that which Saint Paul the Apostle wrote to his beloved disciple Timothy regarding the sacrament of holy orders. When the disciple was dejected through hardship and insults, I admonish thee that thou stir up the grace which is in thee by the imposition of my hands. For God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power, and of love, and of sobriety." 85. 112. "All these things, however, venerable brethren, depend in large measure on the due preparation, remote and proximate, of the parties for marriage. For it cannot be denied that the basis of a happy wedlock, and the ruin of an unhappy one, is prepared and set in the souls of boys and girls during the period of childhood and adolescence. There is danger that those who before marriage sought in all things what is theirs, who indulged even their impure desires, will be in the married state what they were before, that they will reap that which they have sown." 86. "Indeed, within the home there will be sadness, lamentation, mutual contempt, strifes, estrangements, weariness of common life, and, worst of all, such parties will find themselves left alone with their own unconquered passions." 113. "Let then those who are about to enter on married life approach that state well disposed and well prepared, so that they will be able, as far as they can, to help each other in sustaining the vicissitudes of life, and yet more in attending to their eternal salvation, and informing the inner man unto the fullness of the age of Christ." 87. "It will also help them, if they behave towards their cherished offspring as God wills, that is, that the father be truly a father, and the mother truly a mother, through their devout love and unwearying care. The home, though it suffer the want and hardship of this valley of tears, may become for the children in its own way a foretaste of that paradise of delight, in which the Creator placed the first men of the human race. Thus will they be able to bring up their children as perfect men and perfect Christians, they will instill into them a sound understanding of the Catholic Church, and will give them such a disposition and love for their fatherland as duty and gratitude demand. 114. Consequently, both those who are now thinking of entering upon this sacred married state, as well as those who have the charge of educating Christian youth, should, with due regard to the future, prepare that which is good, obviate that which is bad, and recall those points about which we have already spoken in our encyclical letter concerning education. The inclinations of the will, if they are bad, must be repressed from childhood, but such as are good must be fostered, and the mind, particularly of children, should be imbued with doctrines which begin with God, while the heart should be strengthened with the aids of divine grace, in the absence of which no one can curb evil desires, nor can his discipline and formation be brought to complete perfection by the Church. For Christ has provided her with heavenly doctrines and divine sacraments, that he might make her an effectual teacher of men. 88. 115. To the proximate preparation of a good married life belongs very specially the care in choosing a partner. On that depends a great deal whether the forthcoming marriage will be happy or not, since one may be to the other either a great help in leading a Christian life, or a great danger and hindrance. And so that they may not deplore for the rest of their lives the sorrows arising from an indiscreet marriage, those about to enter into wedlock should carefully deliberate in choosing the person with whom henceforward they must live continually. They should, in so deliberating, keep before their minds the thought first of God, and of the true religion of Christ, then of themselves, of their partner, of the children to come, as also of human and civil society, for which wedlock is a fountainhead. Let them diligently pray for divine help, so that they make their choice in accordance with Christian prudence, not indeed led by the blind and unrestrained impulse of lust, nor by any desire of riches or other base influence, but by a true and noble love, and by a sincere affection for the future partner, and then let them strive in their married life for those ends for which the state was constituted by God. Lastly, let them not omit to ask the prudent advice of their parents with regard to the partner, and let them regard this advice in no light manner, in order that by their mature knowledge and experience of human affairs, they may guard against a disastrous choice, and, on the threshold of matrimony, may receive more abundantly the divine blessing of the fourth commandment, honor thy father and thy mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may be well with thee and thou mayest be long lived upon the earth. 89. 116. Now since it is no rare thing to find that the perfect observance of God's commands and conjugal integrity encounter difficulties by reason of the fact that the man and wife are in straitened circumstances, their necessities must be relieved as far as possible. 117. And so, in the first place, every effort must be made to bring about that which our predecessor Leo XLLL, of happy memory, has already insisted upon, 90, namely, that in the state such economic and social methods should be adopted as will enable every head of a family to earn as much as, according to his station in life, is necessary for himself, his wife, and for the rearing of his children, for the laborer is worthy of his hire. 91. To deny this, or to make light of what is equitable, is a grave injustice, and is placed among the greatest sins by Holy Writ. 92. Nor is it lawful to fix such a scanty wage as will be insufficient for the upkeep of the family in the circumstances in which it is placed. 118. Care, however, must be taken that the parties themselves, for a considerable time before entering upon married life, should strive to dispose of, or at least to diminish, the material obstacles in their way. The manner in which this may be done effectively and honestly must be pointed out by those who are experienced. Provision must be made also, in the case of those who are not self-supporting, for joint aid by private or public guilds. 93. 119. When these means which we have pointed out do not fulfill the needs, particularly of a larger or poorer family, Christian charity towards our neighbor absolutely demands that those things which are lacking to the needy should be provided. Hence it is incumbent on the rich to help the poor, so that, having an abundance of this world's goods, they may not expend them fruitlessly, or completely squander them, but employ them for the support and well-being of those who lack the necessities of life. They who give of their substance to Christ in the person of his poor will receive from the Lord a most bountiful reward, when he shall come to judge the world. They who act to the contrary will pay the penalty. 94. Not in vain does the apostle warn us, "He that hath the substance of this world, and shall see his brother in need, and shall shut up his bowels from him, how doth the charity of God abide in him?" 95. 120. If, however, for this purpose, private resources do not suffice, it is the duty of the public authority to supply for the insufficient forces of individual effort, particularly in a matter which is of such importance to the commonweal, touching, as it does, the maintenance of the family and married people. If families, particularly those in which there are many children, have not suitable dwellings, if the husband cannot find employment and means of livelihood, if the necessities of life cannot be purchased except at exorbitant prices, if even the mother of the family, to the great harm of the home, is compelled to go forth and seek a living by her own labor, if she, too, in the ordinary or even extraordinary labors of childbirth, is deprived of proper food, medicine, and the assistance of a skilled physician, it is patent to all to what an extent married people may lose heart, and how home life and the observance of God's commands are rendered difficult for them. Indeed, it is obvious how great a peril can arise to the public security and to the welfare and very life of civil society itself, when such men are reduced to that condition of desperation that, having nothing which they fear to lose, they are emboldened to hope for chance advantage from the upheaval of the state and of established order. 121. Wherefore, those who have the care of the state and of the public good cannot neglect the needs of married people and their families without bringing great harm upon the state and on the common welfare. Hence, in making the laws and in disposing of public funds, they must do their utmost to relieve the needs of the poor, considering such a task as one of the most important of their administrative duties. 122. We are sorry to note that not infrequently nowadays it happens that through a certain inversion of the true order of things, ready and bountiful assistance is provided for the unmarried mother and her illegitimate offspring, who, of course, must be helped in order to avoid a greater evil, which is denied to legitimate mothers, or given sparingly, or almost grudgingly. 123. But not only in regard to temporal goods, venerable brethren, is it the concern of the public authority to make proper provision for matrimony and the family, but also in other things which concern the good of souls. Just laws must be made for the protection of chastity, for reciprocal conjugal aid, and for similar purposes, and these must be faithfully enforced, because, as history testifies, the prosperity of the state and the temporal happiness of its citizens cannot remain safe and sound where the foundation on which they are established, which is the moral order, is weakened, and where the very fountainhead from which the state draws its life, namely, wedlock, and the family, is obstructed by the vices of its citizens. 124. For the preservation of the moral order, neither the laws and sanctions of the temporal power are sufficient, nor is the beauty of virtue, and the expounding of its necessity. Religious authority must enter in to enlighten the mind, to direct the will, and to strengthen human frailty by the assistance of divine grace. Such an authority is found nowhere save in the Church instituted by Christ the Lord. Hence we earnestly exhort in the Lord all those who hold the reins of power, that they establish and maintain firmly harmony and friendship with this Church of Christ, so that through the united activity and energy of both powers the tremendous evils, fruits of those wanton liberties which assail both marriage and the family, and are a menace to both Church and State, may be effectively frustrated. 125. Governments can assist the Church greatly in the execution of its important office, if, in laying down their ordinances, they take account of what is prescribed by divine and ecclesiastical law, and if penalties are fixed for offenders. For as it is, there are those who think that whatever is permitted by the laws of the state, or at least is not punished by them, is allowed also in the moral order, and, because they neither fear God, nor see any reason to fear the laws of man, they act even against their conscience, thus often bringing ruin upon themselves and upon many others. There will be no peril to, or lessening of the rights and integrity of the state, from its association with the Church. Such suspicion and fear is empty and groundless. As Leo XLLL has already so clearly set forth, it is generally agreed, he says, that the founder of the Church, Jesus Christ, wished the spiritual power to be distinct from the civil, and each to be free and unhampered in doing its own work, not forgetting, however, that it is expedient to both, and in the interest of everybody, that there be a harmonious relationship. If the civil power combines in a friendly manner with the spiritual power of the Church, it necessarily follows that both parties will greatly benefit. The dignity of the state will be enhanced, and with religion as its guide, there will never be a rule that is not just, while for the Church, there will be at hand a safeguard and defense which will operate to the public good of the faithful. 96. 126. To bring forward a recent and clear example of what is meant, it has happened quite in consonance with right order, and entirely according to the law of Christ, that in the solemn convention happily entered into between the Holy See and the Kingdom of Italy, also in matrimonial affairs a peaceful settlement and friendly cooperation has been obtained, such as befitted the glorious history of the Italian people and its ancient and sacred traditions. These decrees are to be found in the Lateran Pact. The Italian state, desirous of restoring to the institution of matrimony, which is the basis of the family, that dignity conformable to the traditions of its people, assigns as civil effects of the sacrament of matrimony all that is attributed to it in canon law. 97. To this fundamental norm are added further clauses in the Common Pact. 127. This might well be a striking example to all of how, even in this our own day, in which, sad to say, the absolute separation of the civil power from the Church, and indeed from every religion, is so often taught, the one supreme authority can be united and associated with the other without detriment to the rights and supreme power of either, thus protecting Christian parents from pernicious evils and menacing ruin. 128. All these things which, venerable brethren, prompted by our past solicitude we put before you, we wish, according to the norm of Christian prudence, to be promulgated widely among all our beloved children committed to your care as members of the great family of Christ, that all may be thoroughly acquainted with sound teaching concerning marriage, so that they may be ever on their guard against the dangers advocated by the teachers of error, and most of all, that, denying ungodliness and worldly desires, they may live soberly and justly and godly in this world, looking for the blessed hope and coming of the glory of the great God and our Savior Jesus Christ. 98. 129. May the Father, of whom all paternity in heaven and earth is named, 99, who strengthens the weak and gives courage to the pusillanimous and faint-hearted, and Christ our Lord and Redeemer, the Institutor and Perfecter of the Holy Sacraments, 100, who desired marriage to be and made it the mystical image of His own ineffable union with the Church, and the Holy Ghost, love of God, the light of hearts, and the strength of the mind, grant that all will perceive, will admit with a ready will, and by the grace of God will put into practice what we, by this letter, have expounded concerning the holy sacrament of matrimony, the wonderful law and will of God respecting it, the errors and impending dangers, and the remedies with which they can be counteracted, so that that fruitfulness dedicated to God will flourish again vigorously in Christian wedlock. 130. We most humbly pour forth our earnest prayer at the throne of His grace, that God, the author of all graces, the inspirer of all good desires and deeds, 101, may bring this about, and deign to give it bountifully according to the greatness of His liberality and omnipotence, and, as a token of the abundant blessing of the same omnipotent God, we most lovingly grant to you, venerable brethren, and to the clergy and people committed to your watchful care, the apostolic benediction, given at Rome, in St. Peter's, this 31st day of December, of the year 1930, the 9th of our pontificate.